of that. And I think the most amazing thing I just want to tell you is that I was able to go to both of those services so easily. Usually the crowds are so huge and nearly impossible to experience Christmas in Bethlehem that close.
That singing is really beautiful to listen to. Thanks for sharing, Carrie. Without the crowds and tourists, what are residents, what are officials telling you in Bethlehem? How are they doing?
The economy here is devastated. Bethlehem is dependent on tourism. Hotel occupancy is in the single digits. Stores have closed. Unemployment throughout the West Bank is nearly at 50%. The deputy mayor I spoke with, Hana Hania, told us Palestinians feel like the world has turned their backs on them and they're suffering.
And always we are asking the international community to bring back this message to Bethlehem and to the Holy Land, because we need to live in peace and dignity in our land.
Since the war began after Hamas attacked Israel, killing around 1,200 people on October 7th in 2023, Israel has imposed tough restrictions in the West Bank with new checkpoints and barring Palestinians from working in Israel. And we're seeing Palestinian groups fighting each other here too. The Palestinian Authority has launched a rare crackdown on militants in the West Bank and is making for a tense and complicated situation here.
Thanks so much for your reporting, Carrie.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn in Bethlehem. Democrats are still grappling with Vice President Harris's loss in the presidential election this past November. Now, this coming January, Republicans will control the White House and both chambers of Congress. And some Democrats are looking to state houses for new leaders and new messages. For two House Democrats, the future is actually back in their home states.
These are the only two races in the nation, the first two races in the nation, where we can stand up and say, this is the vision that we have of the future.
That's New Jersey's Mikey Sherrill. She and Virginia Democrat Abigail Spanberger are both running for governor. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh sat down with them together, and she joins me now to talk about their conversation. Deirdre, it's great to have you with us.
Good morning, Asma.
So who are these two women, and why are they making a move out of Congress to run for these executive roles?
Well, Mikey Sherrill's a former Navy helicopter pilot. Spanberger's a former CIA analyst. They're actually roommates in Washington right now. Both were elected in 2018 as a group of more centrist Democrats with national security credentials. They see their experiences in Congress as something that can translate to state houses. They tout their work working across the aisle. But Sherrill did talk about a lack of urgency she's felt in Congress and says there's ability to have more of an impact as an executive, especially on economic issues. Both of these Democrats see their work on the Hill as a model for a way they can operate running a state. Spanberger said the move is more about trying to use her experience in her district, but across the state.
And so for me, the decision to run for governor is not a decision to leave Congress. It's a decision to run for governor, to be able to focus on the things that are priorities, strengthening our public schools, addressing rising costs for Virginians, really dealing with the crisis of supply of housing and all that that impacts.
Spanberger could make history as the first female governor in Virginia. It's also worth noting her likely Republican opponent is also a woman.
Interesting. So, Deirdre, what issues does Spanberger and Mikey Sherrill as well feel are key to the Democratic Party's future?
They both emphasized affordability broadly as sort of the top issue they hear about from voters, but also say abortion access in their states is a concern. Spanberger notes Virginia is the only southern state that hasn't faced new abortion restrictions since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, and she's committing to codifying existing protections. And Sherrill says Democrats can't rely on a single issue.
I don't think it's enough for Democrats to run as anti-Trump, pro-abortion, and hope for great results. That's not enough. We have got to define a vision forward that is going to create opportunity for people, that is going to help economically stabilize people, feel like, look, I'm on steady ground now, and I'm going to be on steady ground in 10 years from now, and my kids are going to have a good future.
You know, neither of these House Democrats directly criticized President Biden or Vice President Harris, but they both stressed that they're both parents of school-age kids, and they get what people are struggling with. They mentioned school quality issues and inflation, and they believe they can connect with voters.
So both of these women were elected during Donald Trump's first term in the White House, and you know, these races that they are running for, New Jersey and Virginia, the governor's races, are really marquee races in 2025 as Trump is heading back to the White House.
Right.
So how much of a factor do they think that he will be in whether or not they get elected?
It's still really early for now. Both of them seem very focused on pivoting away to talking about Trump and talking more about the economy and the issues that they're hearing about. But they know that people are going to be paying a lot of attention to these races. As you noted, these are the only off-year elections. In the past, these governor's races become a referendum on the new president's first year in office. And the other thing is, if they do well, these women could become a blueprint for their party moving forward.
All right, that's NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Asma.
Not surprisingly, Mariah Carey ruled Christmas again. Yes, I happen to fall into the camp of people who absolutely love this song. It's like my jam as I'm driving in to host Morning Edition. Her 1994 song, All I Want for Christmas Is You, just scored its 17th week at the top of the pop chart. Gosh, that is spread over a lot of Christmases. Also in the top 10, old standards from the 1950s, like Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree and Jingle Bell Rock. But Stephen Thompson from NPR Music reports that newer Christmas recordings are finally being added to the mix, too.
Here's a wild statistic. Until this week, the newest holiday song to hit the Billboard Top 10 is from 1999, when Kenny G released a sexy cover of Auld Lang Syne. The song had a millennium remix that incorporated news clips from the 20th century. That helped it reach number 7 in 2000.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
That means that for nearly 25 years, not a single newly recorded holiday song has graced the Billboard Top 10. Nothing by Taylor Swift, nothing by Beyoncé, not one song by any artist whose career began in the 21st century. Hope you like Andy Williams, because if the charts are any indication, the holiday season is all about songs that bored your grandparents. So consider it progress that two holiday songs from this century have ended the drought and hit the top 10 for the very first time this week. Kelly Clarkson's 2013 song Underneath the Tree climbs to number 10. And Ariana Grande's Santa Tell Me from 2014 rises to number 9. Santa, tell me if you're really there. So if you want to know how long it takes a holiday song to travel from new to officially welcomed into the canon, that answer is at least a decade. Even for those of us who've had Santa Tell Me stuck in their head for weeks, it has to count as progress. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on WPR. It is 8:19. Thank you for joining us today on December 25th. Coming up here on the show, community leaders in Steubenville, Ohio, celebrate the holidays by decorating Main Street with hundreds of giant nutcrackers. Plus, later this hour on this Christmas morning, we'll have an episode of Wisconsin Life about one Eau Claire parent's mission to create holiday magic for her son. Those stories still to come, plus news in 11 minutes here on WPR.
Celebrate traditions old and new this holiday season with special programs all this month. Hi, I'm Sarah Ashworth, director of WPR. Find beautiful music, friendly conversation, and engaging entertainment to keep you company at home, at work, and on the go. Explore the full schedule of seasonal programs at WPR.org/holidays, and thanks for listening.
Support for WPR comes from Reynolds Residential Moving, dedicated to providing quality household moving and storage services throughout Wisconsin and North America. More information, including move estimates, at ReynoldsTransfer.com.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different morning show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
Today, mainly cloudy on this December 25th, though in some areas of the state, the sun may be peeking out right now. It'll be cozy, though, lounging inside today. Highs will be in the mid-20s in the north to low 30s in the southern half of the state. Tonight will be cloudy with some areas of fog and patchy freezing drizzle later in the day in the southern parts of Wisconsin. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Information about the wonders of the universe is at templeton.org. From your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialist, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio, and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. Some holiday stories are stranger than fiction, like how once upon a time, writer and humorist David Sedaris worked as a Macy's department store elf. He wrote about his experiences and the unmerry side of Christmas in a collection of short stories called The Santaland Diaries. Here, once again, is our Morning Edition holiday tradition, David Sedaris as Crumpet the Elf.
I wear green velvet knickers, a forest green velvet smock, and a perky little hat decorated with spangles. This is my work uniform. I have spent the last several days sitting in a crowded, windowless Macy's classroom undergoing the first phases of elf training. You can be an entrance elf, a water cooler elf, a bridge elf, train elf, maze elf, island elf, magic window elf, usher elf, cash register elf, or exit elf. We were given a demonstration of various positions in action, acted out by returning elves who were so on stage and goofy that it made me a little sick to my stomach. I don't know that I could look anyone in the eye and exclaim, "Oh my goodness, I think I see Santa." Or, "Can you close your eyes and make a very special Christmas wish?" Everything these elves say seems to have an exclamation point on the end of it. It makes one's mouth hurt to speak with such forced merriment. It embarrasses me to hear people talk this way. I think I'll be a low-key sort of elf. 22,000 people came to see Santa today, and not all of them were well-behaved. Today I witnessed fistfights and vomiting in magnificent tantrums. The back hallway was jammed with people. There was a line for Santa and a line for the women's bathroom. And one woman, after asking me 1,000 questions already, asked, "Which is the line for the women's bathroom?" And I shouted that I thought it was the line with all the women in it. And she said, "I'm going to have you fired." I had 2 people say that to me today. "I'm going to have you fired." Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. Who do these people think they are? "I'm going to have you fired." And I want to lean over and say, "I'm gonna have you killed." The overall cutest elf is a fella from Queens named Richie. His elf name is Snowball, and he tends to ham it up with the children, sometimes tumbling down the path to Santa's house. I generally gag when elves get that cute, but Snowball is hands down adorable. You want to put him in your pocket. Yesterday, Snowball and I worked as Santa elves, and I got excited when he started saying things like, "I'd follow you to Santa's house any day, Crumpet." It made me dizzy, his flirtation. By mid-afternoon, I was running into walls. By late afternoon, Snowball had cooled down. By the end of our shift, we were in the bathroom, changing our clothes, and all of a sudden, we were surrounded by five Santas and three other elves. All of them were guys that Snowball had been flirting with. Snowball just leads elves on, elves and Santas. This morning, I worked as an exit elf, telling people in a loud voice, "This way out of Santa Land." A woman was standing at one of the cash registers, paying for her pictures while her son lay beneath her, kicking and heaving, having a tantrum. The woman said, "Riley, if you don't start behaving yourself, Santa's not going to bring you any of those toys you asked for." The child said, "He is too going to bring me toys, liar. He already told me." The woman grabbed my arm and said, "You there, elf. Tell Riley here that if he doesn't start behaving immediately, then Santa's going to change his mind and bring him coal for Christmas." I said that Santa changed his policy and no longer traffics in coal. Instead, if you're bad, he comes to your house and steals things. I told Riley that if he didn't behave himself, Santa was going to take away his TV and all his electrical appliances and leave him in the dark. The woman got a worried look on her face and said, "All right, that's enough." I said, "He's going to take your car and your furniture and all of your towels and blankets and leave you with nothing." The mother said, "No, that's enough, really." This afternoon, I was stuck being photo elf for Santa Santa. Santa Santa has an elaborate little act for the children. He'll talk to them and give a hearty chuckle and ring his bells, and then he asks them to name their favorite Christmas carol. Santa then asks if they'll sing it for him. The children are shy and don't want to sing out loud, so Santa Santa says, "Oh, little elf, help young Brenda here sing that favorite carol of hers." Late in the afternoon, a child said she didn't know what her favorite Christmas carol was. Santa Santa suggested "Away in a Manger." The girl agreed to it but didn't want to sing because she didn't know the words. Santa Santa said, "Oh, little elf, come sing Away in the Manger for us." It didn't seem fair that I should have to solo, so I sang it the way Billie Holiday might have sang if she'd put out a Christmas album. "Away in a manger, no crib for a bed. The little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head." Santa Santa did not allow me to finish. This evening I was sent to be a photo elf. Once a child starts crying, it's all over. The parents had planned to send these pictures as cards or store them away until the child is grown and can lie, claiming to remember the experience. Tonight I saw a woman slap and shake her crying child. She yelled, "Rachel, get on that man's lap and smile or I'll give you something to cry about." Then she sat Rachel on Santa's lap and I took the picture, which supposedly means, on paper, that everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be, that everything is snowy and wonderful. It's not about the child or Santa or Christmas or anything, but the parents' idea of a world they cannot make work for them.
Writer and humorist David Sedaris reading from his Santaland Diaries. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
In the new film, A Complete Unknown, actor Timothée Chalamet looks like young Bob Dylan, talks like young Bob Dylan, and even learned to play guitar and harmonica for the role.
You hear the iron ore in his voice. You hear the North Country blues when he talks. I don't want to lose any part of that.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Timothée Chalamet on his new movie, A Complete Unknown, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can listen to All Things Considered from 4 until 6:30 this afternoon here on WPR.
This is WPR News.
A new ice skating trail in Vilas County opened this week. More on the glide is coming up in the WPR newscast in a few minutes.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. In Paris, Notre Dame Cathedral held its Christmas Eve Mass more than 5 years after being nearly destroyed in a fire. American tourist Ali Bennard was impressed by the renovation.
They did such an amazing job. It looks beautiful. I saw it once before many, many years ago, and so it was just really special to be back and just see all the hard work that's gone back into it. It was really nice. Blew us away. It's a really special night. It was really a nice thing to be a part of.
In Haiti, armed men opened fire at the reopening of a hospital in Port-au-Prince yesterday. Officials say two reporters and a police officer were killed. Harold Isaac reports armed gangs are in near control of the Haitian capital.
The Vivre Ensemble gang coalition has essentially emerged this year as a coalition of all the factions of gangs in the metropolitan area of Port-au-Prince. And this specific attack was carried out by one of its leaders called Izo, who was overseeing the scene with a drone and essentially showing where you could see bodies of the journalists and police officers attacked. It's really a big challenge to the Haitian state, which has been unable to really turn the tide on this wave of violence that the gangs have been waging on the city.
This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. Good morning. I'm Mallory Chang. Thank you for being here this morning with us. A new ice skating attraction opened this month in the North Woods. Boulder Junction's new skating ribbon is about 3/4 of a mile long. It's a loop from the town's winter park through forest land on a former cross-country skiing track, and it's a chance for visitors with skates to glide through the snowy woods. The trail is the first rural ice skating ribbon to open in Wisconsin. Laura Birch is chair of the Boulder Junction Park Board. She says she hopes for a cold winter and a boost to seasonal tourism.
Last winter, with no snow and no snowmobiling, we took a hit. The town took a hit. So we're hoping this will really help.
To prepare the trail, volunteers attached an open water tank to their trucks and made laps on the course that built a base of ice. The town also purchased a Zamboni that they'll use to smooth the ice out each day. Former state senators Tim Cullen and George Petak have died. Cullen, a Democrat from Janesville, died Monday afternoon after being hospitalized with a heart condition, WCLO reports. He was 80 years old. He was first elected to the state Senate in 1974 and became majority leader in 1982. He served until 1987 when he went to work for former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson's administration. Cullen is remembered for crossing party lines. He was elected again in 2010 and served until he retired in 2015. Petak, who died in the early morning on Tuesday, was 75 years old. He was a Republican who was first elected to the Senate in 1990. He was defeated in a 1996 recall after he was the deciding vote to provide public funding to fund and build the Milwaukee Brewers Stadium. Petak was the first state lawmaker in Wisconsin history to be removed through a recall. With the weather on this December 25th, mainly cloudy today. It's a bit bright and the sun is peeking out in some areas of the state, though, right now. It'll be cozy lounging inside weather today with highs in the mid-20s in the north to low 30s in the southern half of the state. Tonight will be cloudy with some areas of fog and patchy freezing drizzle later in the day in the southern parts of Wisconsin. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
Over the past few years, heat pumps have outsold gas furnaces in the United States. Heat pumps are climate friendly, so the Biden administration issued federal tax credits for them. But what does a Trump presidency and a Republican Congress mean for that money? Joining us now to parse through that is Julia Simon from NPR's Climate Desk. Hey there, Julia.
Good morning.
So before we get into the questions about money, remind us, what exactly is a heat pump? What does it do?
Heat pumps, they're kind of a misnomer because they can heat and cool your home. They use refrigerants and electricity and some physics involving the movement of heat. And heat pumps these days, they're very efficient. Some heat pumps are specifically designed for cold climates. Your typical furnace runs on fossil fuels like natural gas. And scientists see heat pumps as a climate solution because they run on electricity that's increasingly powered by renewables, not fossil fuels.
Let's talk about the money here. The Biden administration's big climate legislation, known as the Inflation Reduction Act, introduced new federal tax incentives for heat pumps. What is available to consumers right now at this moment?
So the federal tax credit is $2,000 for heat pump equipment and installation. It's a tax credit, so basically it lowers your final tax bill. Mm-hmm. Something to remember is to get it, the heat pump has to meet a particular energy efficiency standard, so definitely make sure you're buying an eligible heat pump. We link to the website where you can check that at npr.org.
All right. That is the federal money component here, but are there additional financial incentives for new heat pumps at the local state level?
There are lots of local utilities have incentives. Check your utility's website to see if they offer heat pump money. Also, there are incentives from states, cities. The nonprofit Rewiring America has a website, so you can plug in your zip code and income level and figure out what money you qualify for. And again, we link to that at npr.org.
Got it. So let's talk more about the money that comes directly from the Inflation Reduction Act. How might the politics of this moment, a second Trump administration and a GOP-controlled Congress, impact this heat pump money?
I spoke to Shooting Pomerleau at the American Action Forum, a conservative think tank. She is not optimistic about the future of that $2,000 federal tax credit.
A lot of the tax provisions or direct spending programs under the Inflation Reduction Act will likely be on the chopping board.
Pomerleau notes that the incoming Republican-led Congress, they'll be looking for revenue to pay for planned tax cuts. So with that in mind, I asked her, if someone is sure that they definitely want to buy a heat pump, would you in this case say, hey, if you really want that tax credit, you should buy it sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I definitely think so.
She thinks federal heat pump money is likely to dry up. But she says some states may choose to continue incentive programs. Heat pump rebate programs, they've been popular in red and purple states as well as blue states. So some of that local money may stick around.
That is NPR's Julia Simon. Julia, thanks.
Thank you, Asma.
A village of giant nutcrackers is reviving Christmas celebrations in Steubenville, Ohio. The small town has faced economic challenges since its last steel mill closed nearly two decades ago. Aaron Gottsacker with the Ohio Newsroom has a story.
Brody Stutzman stands in his workshop considering a nearly finished nutcracker. Unlike the traditional mantle topping toy, this one is almost as tall as he is. He shakes a bottle of spray paint before applying a regal pattern onto the figure's red coat, attaches the lower jaw onto another.
Every one of these nutcrackers here has something that I'm doing to it. And I'm kind of just moving around, trying to finish things up. So I'm still doing some painting on this one, doing some stenciling with that.
A pair of the figures stand Ramrod Street, blank faces tilted upwards, awaiting a brush to paint bright eyes and mustaches onto their rosy cheeks. Two freshly painted black arms dangle from the ceiling to dry. Nearby, another nutcracker balances upside down on a top hat. The giant toy Stutzman creates lines Steubenville's main drag to create a unique walkthrough attraction, the Nutcracker Village.
It's like an army of toys in the streets downtown.
Stutzman has been making the nutcrackers for the city's display for 10 years. Before that, Steubenville's Christmas celebrations were dramatically smaller.
They had
a Christmas parade that had been poorly attended.
That's Gretchen Nelson, Stutzman's mother-in-law. At the time, she remembers community leaders getting together to brainstorm ways to revive the city's holiday celebrations. Someone suggested decorating storefront windows with nutcrackers. Her husband suggested scaling that idea up.
We had a manufacturing company, and we primarily make, like, religious art, but we make a lot of different things. And so, and he is a woodworker. And so Mark was like, what if we made big nutcrackers?
The couple's daughter created designs for the giant toys, and they enlisted their son-in-law, Stutzman, to bring them to life. That first year, he built 37 nutcrackers. The next year, 75. He handcrafts each one from scratch, starting with a 200-pound block of styrofoam.
We cut it into smaller blocks. With this contraption, it's a hot wire cutter, and it, as you can see, it moves back and forth.
Then a wood lathe rotates the block like a pottery wheel. And as it's spinning, Stutzman uses a blade to give their toy bodies distinct shapes.
You then sand it smooth, and then you coat it in fiberglass with a brush. And then when that dries, you sand it, and you can sand it on the lathe as well. And that gets that final complete version before you're ready to paint it.
There are more than 200 on display in downtown Steubenville. Some are traditional soldiers. Others are recognizable characters like Charlie Brown, Mary Poppins, and the cast of The Wizard of Oz.
So this one here is Flick from A Christmas Story when he sticks his tongue to the flagpole.
The festive Nutcracker Village attracts lots of visitors. Last year, more than five times the city's 18,000 residents showed up. Nelson says that scale of tourism is working wonders to revitalize the city's streets. Her family alone decided to invest in a building that had been mostly empty since 1970.
The reason that we opened the coffee shop and the popcorn store and the Christmas store was because we saw the value in what was happening with the nutcrackers. And my husband felt like, all right, we'll just, you know, put our money where our mouth is and invest in the downtown.
Others followed suit.
Or since we started the Nutcracker Village, a pottery studio has opened, a cigar store has opened, a bookstore remained open.
So while Steubenville's giant nutcrackers don't come to life themselves on long December nights, they are breathing new life into the city's downtown. For NPR, I'm Erin Gottsacker in Steubenville, Ohio.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Mallory Chang. Thank you for being here today. Coming up here on the show, we'll have an episode of Wisconsin Life about one parent who went on a quest to find a peef bear for her son. That story is coming up in a few minutes. Plus, the longtime pilot of the only Ohio River ferry in West Virginia is retiring. We'll take a ride with him this morning. That's all coming ahead here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hey, it's A. Martinez. Listening to Morning Edition is a lot like loading up your plate at a holiday dessert table. It's a familiar ritual that you look forward to, but what's on the table is different every time. Some parts are sweeter than others, and whatever you take, it always fills you up.
It's a treat. It's quite the treat.
Dig in every weekday morning from NPR News.
Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, a family and employee-owned company dedicated to providing construction, technical, and real estate solutions in a variety of markets nationwide. Featured projects and more at bolt.com.
WGTD.org is your portal to public radio, beginning with local news, station information, program schedules, old programs, and videos. WGTD.org includes links to NPR, Wisconsin Public Radio, and WGTD's Facebook page.
On WPR, here's some of what's happening in the news. Richard Perry, the record producer behind You're So Vain and other hits, has died at 82 years old. He died on Tuesday after suffering cardiac arrest. Four Milwaukee Alders are exploring if refunds are possible to residents of more than $11 million the city collects in annual snow plowing fees. In a joint statement, the aldermen said it was in response to what they considered a poor performance by the Department of Public Works in clearing streets after last Friday's snowstorm. The Department of Public Works Committee is set to hear the fee refund proposal on January 8, 2025. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, but you always can get more news and stay up to date on the latest information about Wisconsin and the world at WPR.org or on our daily news podcast, Wisconsin Today Morning News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Mallory Chang. It's now time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about holiday magic.
Parents will go to great lengths to make sure that their kids have the perfect Christmas. Parents like Jan Larson of Eau Claire, who tells us about the quest she went on to find a particular bear for her son.
Mom, Dad, our youngest son, Dana's plaintive words travel from his bedroom down the hall and into the kitchen. I can't find Peef. These words are not particularly alarming on a clear summer day. As the ward of a loving but adventurous four-year-old, Peef might have burrowed under the covers for another 40 winks. Perhaps he has tucked himself behind the living room couch to initiate a favorite game of hide and seek. Or Peef could have retreated to the reading loft, where Dana will find him patiently waiting among the books and toys the two so often share together. For Peef is a magic bear whose fur is cut from cloth, and anywhere that Dana goes, well, Peef is sure to follow. I turn to assure the dark brown eyes filled with concern standing before me. Honey, don't worry, we'll find him. What I don't know is just how far Peef has gone and how far I will need to go to keep my promise. Peef is the progeny of two Christmas books. In book one, a lonely Santa makes Peef from the elves' favorite scraps of fabric. Peef is his constant companion, joining him on his sleigh to deliver toys every Christmas Eve. But by book two, Peef is doubting his purpose. He longs to join the other toys in their journey to the arms of a loving girl or boy. And so, on one snowy Christmas Eve, Santa bids Peef a tender goodbye and chooses one special little boy to love and cherish Peef forever. Dana knows he is that boy. He showers Peef with all the love and attention due a magic Christmas bear. They are now the constant companions, taking trips to the park, to the library, and to Grandma and Grandpa's house. But on this morning, and many mornings for weeks to follow, Peef is not burrowed under the covers, or tucked behind the couch, or waiting in the loft for his boy. My husband Lorne and I brace for the grief we feel sure will develop, and talk about ways to distract Dana. In the end, Dana comes up with his own coping mechanism. Peef, he announces some weeks after the bear's departure, is not lost. He missed Santa and went back to the North Pole for a visit. He'll be home for Christmas. Dana's storyline continues into late summer and early fall. He wonders aloud at what toys Peef and Santa might be creating in the workshop. Our parental strategy of waiting for Dana to forget Peef is not working. Our son's persistent narrative and innocent hope sends me searching. Could Peef be home for Christmas? I call vendors in Connecticut, scour eBay and collectors' websites, and tap into my mom network. It is December 23rd. I sit staring at the lights of the Christmas tree, hoping for inspiration. The books. I rummage through our collection of Christmas tales spread beneath the tree until I find what I need. I flip open the back cover. The author is from Minnesota. I snap open my laptop. A few clicks later, and I have him. A few more, and a number. Hello? You don't know me, but... The words come in a rush. I tell Tom Hegg, the man whose imagination has created Dana's dearest companion, of my search. When I finish, I can hear the smile behind his voice. Which one? I have boxes of them in the garage. Waves of relief wash over me. A full description of Peef guarantees he is just right. Via overnight express, Peef is coming home. I hide the box in our bedroom. Now home, how should Peef make his entrance? It is Lauren's idea. We tuck our youngest into bed and wait until his breaths are slow and deep. We nestle Peef into Dana's arms. It is the night before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature is stirring as the Larsons dream the sweetest of dreams. We wake to Christmas joy. "Mom! Dad!" Dana shouts with glee. "It's Peef! He's back! And he's grown!"
Jan Larson is a professor emeritus from the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
I'm Gregory Berg. The studios of WGTD will be closed from December 28th through January 1st for the holidays, and during that time there will be no morning show broadcast. But each and every day there will be a different morning show podcast episode for you to enjoy, with interviews drawn from the morning show archives. The podcast version of the morning show is available wherever you get your podcasts: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. But be sure to look for the right name, The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
Thank you for joining us for Morning Edition here on WPR. In sports, there's no major Wisconsin sports teams playing on this Christmas Day, but there are a few NBA games going on. Games start at 11 a.m. with the San Antonio Spurs and New York Knicks playing, and the latest game starts at 9:30 tonight with the Denver Nuggets playing against the Phoenix Suns, with a plural. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. The town of Sistersville, West Virginia, is home to the last ferry crossing in the Mountain State. The Sistersville Ferry has been serving this tiny community for over 200 years. For the past 12, Captain Bo House has been at the helm, but he's retiring. Zach Harold with West Virginia Public Broadcasting hopped a ride with him.
Let's say you find yourself in Sistersville, West Virginia, and you really have a hankering for a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich from the Riverview Restaurant, just across the Ohio River in tiny Fly, Ohio. You have a couple options. Drive up to New Martinsville, cross the bridge, and head back down. That's about a 30-minute trip. Or drive down to St. Mary's, cross there. That's about a 45-minute trip. Or you could just take the Sistersville Ferry, which will only require 10 minutes of your time and a $5 bill.
There's not a schedule. It's what I call on demand.
That's Ferry Captain Bo House.
Right now we're on the West Virginia side. A car pulled up, so we're getting ready to go to Fly, Ohio. And we're going to sit there until a car shows up there, or if a car shows up on the West Virginia side, but then we'll come back and get them.
This is the only ferry in West Virginia, and one of only six ferry crossings left on the entire Ohio River. Years ago, when the oil and gas industries dominated the economy here, it ran daily. Now it's a local tradition, a novelty, a tourist attraction. With a dozen seasons now behind him, Bo knows all the intricacies of this crossing, like the sandbars hidden beneath the water's surface and how a wind from the north will push the boat sideways.
Today's today. That's one.
Nicole Eastham and her family pull onto the ferry in their red Ram pickup. They're regulars and use the ferry to get to their property across the river. And they know this is Bo's last day as ferry captain. Daughter Kaylin and son Avery jump out of the truck to greet Bo. Nicole said at this point, he's basically part of the family.
He's known my daughter since she was just a baby, and he knew Avery before he was born. I mean, I rode when I was pregnant with Avery, so he's literally seen him grow up.
I just enjoy watching families grow, talking, watching the kids grow up. The kids like coming up in the pilot house and steering.
Bo took this job after driving boats for the U.S. Coast Guard for 30 years.
When I retired from the Coast Guard, my wife asked me if I was going to be okay, because I won't be on the water. And it turned out that I'm on the water, and I enjoy it. I don't know that I'll miss it, but I definitely enjoyed it while I'm doing it.
Bo says he's ready for some longer journeys, beyond the back and forth of the Ohio River. And when the ferry season restarts in the spring, this 200-year-old tradition will be kept alive by a new captain, who will pilot the only ferry in West Virginia. For NPR News, I'm Zach Harold in Sistersville.
Sometimes the best gifts are the ones you already have and rediscover later on. Recently, the Kitchen Sisters, producers Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, stumbled across an interview they recorded more than 40 years ago. It's a conversation with Edna Lewis, an author, chef, and pioneer of Southern cooking. She died in 2006. Lewis wrote about growing up in Freetown, Virginia, a small farming community of formerly enslaved people and their descendants. Here she is in 1983, remembering Christmas traditions in Freetown.
Edna, can you tell me about Freetown? Tell me about where you grew up.
They call it Freetown because the settlers were freed slaves, and that just sort of coined the phrase of being a place of free people. The name town is sort of misleading because it wasn't a town. It was a small community of about a dozen families, not related but very closely associated with each other. My grandfather was one of the three first people that settled there in the 1860s, and they all settled sort of in a circle. My grandfather's house was in the center. They participated together in producing their crops and raising their children and their pigs. It was like one big family. And I'm sure in some instances they lived better than some big family, more harmonious, because they had a great discipline. I always felt loved and unafraid because everybody was your parent and everybody loved you, and it was just an experience that one couldn't forget.
What about Christmas time?
It was just the most exciting time to prepare for because of the cooking and the smells in the kitchen, and then the final Christmas Eve.
What was the dinner that night?
Oh, definitely oysters. That was maybe oyster stew or fried oysters, cider, or if the grown-ups had wine. You're really saving your taste for Christmas Day. Early in the morning before daylight, about 5 o'clock. The deep winter would be dark. Fireworks were set off, things called sparkles, and the children could hold them. But the big Roman candles made a big noise, were done by the grown-ups. My father would set off the big ones. Wouldn't be Christmas without sparkles and the candles. Only the last 15 or 20 minutes, you woke up the whole neighborhood. Couldn't wait to rush to get our stock, and we only saw oranges Christmas Eve. They would be in the bottom of each stocking, and hanging by the fireplace, the heat would bring out the fragrance of the oil and the orange, and that would be the first thing we would smell coming down the stairs. Gave such an aroma and excitement. Christmas, everything would be brought out, and the sideboard would be loaded. All the food you'd been preparing all summer into the fall. This would be Christmas dinner. Roast chicken with dressing, whipped white potatoes, baked rabbits, steamed wild watercress. The watercress grew wild along the lowlands and along the stream. Lima beans and cream, spiced sickle pears, sweet cucumber pickle, grape jelly, biscuits, hot minced pie, persimmon pudding with clear sauce, fruit cake, coconut layer cake, caramel fudge, chocolate fudge, divinity cream, all these were homemade. Popcorn, bowl of oranges, raisin clusters, Brazil nuts, almonds, blackberry wine, and coffee. You spend just intense time working on something and that is eaten and gone. But I think some foods linger, which although they're eaten and gone, I don't think it's lost. I think if it's good, it'll be remembered.
That was chef and author Edna Lewis, recorded in 1983 by producers Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Mallory Chang. Thank you for joining us this morning here on WPR for Morning Edition on this December 25th. It was a lot of fun this morning. Alex will be back tomorrow with his Morning Edition duties. Have a great day. I hope you all take care and have rest.
Support for WPR comes from Great River Shakespeare Festival and Mitchell Hamlin School of Law.
Join the team of organizations that support a wide variety of informative and inspiring programs for the people of Wisconsin. More at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Whether you need information about Medicare, housing options, home care, or accessible transportation, the ADRC is the place to start. Their services are free. Call 262-605-6646.
Your gateway to public radio is WGT.